Chapter 1, The Object of Knowledge. Looks like we may finish it in this session. In the previous paragraph, Sri Aurobindo had been discussing the subtle ranges of conscious being between the depth of where the soul resides and the superficial external prospects of nature. He continues from that point, discussing the individual, the universe, and their relationship to the Supreme. So the object of knowledge has to be attained by the perceiver of knowledge, otherwise there is no knowledge if one doesn't know. If there isn't a known and a knower, then there is no knowledge. So somewhere there must be within the oneness of the Supreme the capacity to differentiate from the one into the many. Now, you'll note if you have copies of the reprint of the Arya that this December 1915 issue obviously began with The Life Divine, and it was titled The Divine Soul. And it opened with a citation from the Isha Upanishad, which is relevant to what he's writing about here in the next article, The Synthesis of Yoga. He quoted the seventh verse from the Isha Upanishad. He, in whom the self has become all existences, and he has the knowledge, how shall he be deluded? Whence shall he have grief, who sees everywhere oneness? Ekatvam. This is how he translated it there, as opposed to his actual translation later of the Isha. But we can take it as setting a context that this knowledge extinguishes all possibility of grief and brings you into a felt oneness with that being who manifests and contains all existences. And we are one with that one. So, let's start. In relation to the individual, the Supreme is our own true and highest self, that which ultimately we are in our essence, that of which we are in our manifested nature. A spiritual knowledge moved to arrive at the true self in us must reject, as the traditional way of knowledge rejects, all misleading appearances. It must discover that the body is not our self, our foundation of existence. It is a sensible form of the infinite. And Sri Aurobindo can go back, as he often will, when he wants to establish himself within ancient Vedantic text. He will go not to Shankara's treatises or Advaita Vedanta. He will go instead to the Upanishads. And the oldest of all the Upanishads is the Brihadaranyaka. Brihad, the great, Aranyaka, forest. So this is the great treatise of the forest. This is from its fourth section of the fourth chapter, the 12th verse. It says, if one knew Atman with the thought, I am he, with what desire? For love of what would he cling to the body? In other words, when you've had the essential experience of the self, You no longer are attached to this frail form, this ever-changing form. This cannot be our self. If self there is, this is not the self. So Sri Aurobindo avers with ancient Vedanta that that is a misleading appearance, that we cannot simply be this and be. The experience of matter as the world's soul foundation, and the physical brain and nerves and cells and molecules as the one truth of all things in us, the ponderous, inadequate basis of materialism, is a delusion, a half-view taken for the whole, the dark bottom or shadow of things misconceived as the luminous substance, the effective figure of zero for the integer. We are looking for an integral knowledge, which makes us one with that which is the integer. The materialist idea mistakes a creation for the creative power, a means of expression for that which is expressed and expresses. Matter and our physical brain and nerves and body are the field and foundation for one action of a vital force that serves to connect the self with the form of its works and maintains them by its direct dynamis. The material movements are an exterior notation by which the soul represents its perceptions of certain truths of the infinite and makes them effective in the terms of substance. These things are a language, a notation, a hieroglyphic, a system of symbols, not themselves the deepest, truest sense of the things they intimate. So all forms are symbols of that which wants to experience itself. It's probably not an inopportune time to note that Brahman, that reality, which is ever-expanding, ever-growing, in Vedantic language never loses its context as the word. It is the word that expresses the infinite, which becomes all of this largely, greatly. So Brahman is that which grows greatly. Neither is the life ourself, the vitality, the energy which plays in the brain, nerves, and body. It is a power and not the whole power of the infinite. So he has distinguished the self from identification with the body merely. He is now distinguishing the self, ourself, from the life, the dynamic power that drives the body, merely. The experience of a life force instrumentalizing matter as the foundation, source, and true sum of all things, the vibrating, unsteady basis of vitalism, is a delusion, a half-view taken for the whole, a tide on a near shore misconceived as all the ocean and its waters. Vitalism, I guess you could say this is the élan vital of Henri Bergson, the whole evolutionary idea that the world is an expression of will, forceful expansion, etc. An early evolutionary view, and Sri Aurobindo obviously takes early evolutionary thinkers and greatly expands upon them. But no, things cannot be expressed simply as the movement of vital energy. And note that he means here that this vitality that we experience, this prana that we experience, is the expression of a power of the infinite, chit shakti, the conscious power of that which really is, sat. The vitalist idea takes something powerful, but outward for the essence. Life force is the dynamization of a consciousness which exceeds it. Ah, chit shakti. That consciousness is felt and acts, but does not become valid to us in intelligence until we arrive at the higher term of mind, our present summit. Mind is here apparently a creation of life, but it is really the ulterior, not the ultimate, sense of life itself and what is behind it, and a more conscious formulation of its secret. Mind is an expression not of life, but of that of which life itself is a less luminous expression. And yet mind also, our mentality, our thinking, understanding part, is not ourself, is not that, not the end or the beginning. It is a half-light thrown from the infinite. The experience of mind as the creator of forms and things and of these forms and things existing in the mind only, the thin, subtle basis of idealism, is also a delusion, a half-view taken for the whole, a pale, refracted light idealized as the burning body of the sun and its splendor. Well, this is Yogacara Buddhism, idealistic Buddhism, that all exists only in the consciousness of enlightenment. Then, how do you explain unenlightenment? There we go again. Orrin Barclay, you know, to which Sam had the appropriate answer, then explain this, and he kicks a stone. This idealist vision also does not arrive at the essence of being, does not even touch it, but only an inferior mode of nature. Mind is the dubious outer penumbra of a conscious existence, which is not limited by mentality, but exceeds it. The method of the traditional way of knowledge, eliminating all these things, arrives at the conception and realization of a pure conscious existence. Self-aware, self-blissful, unconditioned by mind and life and body, and to its ultimate positive experience that is Atman, the self, the original and essential nature of our existence. So, to eliminate these things, to look at the body and say, I am not this, to look at the life and say, I am not that, to look at the mind and all of the ideas that populate that conscious space and say, I am not that, drives you through reflection, vichara, or through meditation, dharana, concentration, and then dhyana, meditation, into an experience of that thing which is beyond all of these figurations of being. Here, at last, there is something centrally true, but in its haste to arrive at it, this knowledge assumes that there is nothing between the thinking mind and the highest, buddhe paratas tu saha, and shutting its eyes in samadhi, tries to rush through all that actually intervenes without even seeing these great and luminous kingdoms of the spirit. This is Sri Aurobindo's experience as well. Having attained enlightenment and living in that state beyond ego, in identity, if you can call it that, with that which alone was real, there was no experience of the supervening planes above mind. It is when he is placed in solitary confinement in the Alipur jail, that alone with himself and that highest self, he discovers that self everywhere, that it is an omnipresent being, posited in all these possible scenes and figurations of itself, that leads him to a secret knowledge of what is behind the world, and then, in the interior reaches that turn upwards, finds superior planes of conscious awareness above, and becomes aware of all that leads from this to that, and how this comes from that. A secret door to the staircase, which was undiscovered. Undiscoverable if mind is the only way we achieve silence, oneness of being with Atman. But there are other ways. So, these great and luminous kingdoms of the spirit, perhaps it arrives at its object, but only to fall asleep in the infinite. Or if it remains awake, it is in the highest experience of the Supreme into which the self-annulling mind can enter, but not in the Supreme of the Supreme, Paratpara, literally the Supreme of the Supreme. The mind can only be aware of the self in a mentalized spiritual thinness, only of the mind reflected Satchit Ananda. So it is an insufficient knowledge. Sri Aurobindo, as you know from our citation of it from his letters, identifies Shankara's experience of spiritual truth as arriving at that of the spiritual mind. It is through this mind that he came to know, to experience that reality, and so was limited. That must be real, therefore this is unreal. The dividing mind, yeah. But that mind, that realization was already seen as insufficient in both the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and in the Isha Upanishad. Into blind darkness they enter who worship ignorance. So, to mistake the externalities for the truth, yes, that's a darkness. Into a greater darkness they enter who delight in knowledge only. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad 4.4.10 and Isha Upanishad 9. Delight, ratta, rolling around in bliss. The highest truth, the integral self-knowledge, is not to be gained by this self-blinded leap into the absolute, but by a patient transit beyond the mind into the truth consciousness, where the infinite can be known, felt, seen, experienced in all the fullness of its unending riches. If the mind gives you spiritual thinness, the supramental gives you fullness. Purnam madaha, purnam midam. All that satisfies, that fulfills, and gives you spiritual satiety. And there we discover this self that we are to be not only a static, tenuous, vacant Atman, but a great dynamic spirit, individual, universal, and transcendent. That self and spirit cannot be expressed by the mind's abstract generalizations. All the inspired descriptions of the seers and mystics cannot exhaust its contents and its splendors. Remember, he is speaking about two mighty realizations that he had. That first, that immersion into Brahmic Nirvana. He had great respect for that. He realized that that is release from ignorance. But it was his second realization, where he discovered the omnipresent divine. That he writes about rapturously. That he invites you to, because it is the larger experience. There is great joy. There you find the key to existence. In relation to the universe, the supreme is Brahman, the one reality which is not only the spiritual material and conscious substance of all ideas and forces and forms of the universe, but their origin, support, and possessor, the cosmic and supracosmic spirit. Now remember, Brahman is originally a word. It describes the creative word, the creative power of the divine, which expresses and expands and becomes great and greater and greatest. This is the nature of Brahman, dynamic, not merely static, powerful, but the inexpressible word has expressed itself. What is ineffable has poured itself out into limitless symbols, all of which populate the one universe which is contained within its conscious being. All the last terms to which we can reduce the universe, force and matter, name and form, nama and rupa, purusha and prakriti, person and nature, are still not entirely that which the universe really is, either in itself or its nature. As all that we are is the play and form, the mental, psychic, vital, and physical expression of a supreme self, unconditioned by mind and life and body, the universe too is the play and form and cosmic soul expression and nature expression of a supreme existence which is unconditioned by force and matter, unconditioned by idea and name and form, unconditioned by the fundamental distinction of purusha and prakriti. Our supreme self and the supreme existence which has become the universe are one spirit, one self, and one existence. The individual is in nature one expression of the universal being, in spirit an emanation of the transcendence. For if he finds his self, he finds too that his own true self is not this natural personality, this created individuality, but is a universal being in its relations with others and with nature, and in its upward term, a portion or the living front of a supreme transcendental spirit. This goes back to the Isha Upanishad. This is the 8th verse. It is he that has gone abroad. That which is bright, bodiless, without scar of imperfection, without sinews, pure, unpierced by evil. The seer, Kavi, their thinker, Manishi, the one who becomes everywhere, the self-existent Swayambhu, has ordered objects perfectly according to their nature from years sempiternal. This supreme existence is not conditioned by the individual or by the universe. A spiritual knowledge can therefore surpass or even eliminate these two powers of the spirit and arrive at the conception of something utterly transcendent, something that is unnameable and mentally unknowable, a sheer absolute. The traditional way of knowledge, Jnana Yoga, eliminates individual and universe. The absolute it seeks after is featureless, indefinable, relationless, not this, not that, neti, neti. Now this goes back to the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad also, 2, 3, 6, if you want to look it up. But the Brihadaranyaka brings to us the entire tessellated universe as figurations immensely various of this single reality, Brahman. Everywhere you look, it is that. So it is not simply not this, not that. It's true. It's not completely contained in this or that. And if you confuse the superficies for the profundities, then my goodness, you have lost the whole game. So he continues, and yet we can say of it that it is one, that it is infinite, that it is ineffable bliss, consciousness, existence. Again, Satchit-ananda, a term that doesn't come into play for another couple of thousand years, but it's a great idea and it really captures what the Upanishads are driving at. Although unknowable to the mind, yet through our individual being and through the names and forms of the universe, nama, rupa, we can approach the realization of the Supreme Self, that is Brahman, and by the realization of the Self, we come to a certain realization also of this utter absolute, of which our true self is the essential form in our consciousness. Ah, swarupa, one's own form, is a conscious form, not an exteriorized form. It is one with Paramatman, with the Supreme Self. It is one with the Supreme of the Supreme. The jiva is identical to the Paramatma. These are the devices the human mind is compelled to use if it is to form to itself any conception at all of a transcendent and unconditioned absolute. The system of negation, neti neti, not this, not that, is indispensable to it in order to get rid of its own definitions and limited experience. It is obliged to escape through a vague indefinite into the infinite. For it lives in a closed prison of constructions and representations that are necessary for its action, but are not the self-existent truth, either of matter or life or mind or spirit. But if we can once cross beyond the mind's frontier twilight, into the vast plane of supramental knowledge, these devices cease to be indispensable. Supermind has quite another, a positive and direct and living experience of the Supreme Infinite. The Absolute is beyond personality and beyond impersonality. And yet it is both the impersonal and the supreme person and all persons. The absolute is beyond the distinction of unity and multiplicity. And yet it is the one and the innumerable many in all the universes. Well, we've cited the Isha Upanishad, but you can also cite the Mandukya Upanishad in its 7th verse. It speaks about that which goes beyond the state of blanked out bliss, which is the completely fused self and object, that great state of the deep sleep, Sushupti, and encourages the seeker to go beyond into a 4th state, Chaturtham, and that includes the waking, the dreaming, the deep sleep state in its own vastness. That is the greater knowledge. That's the knowledge beyond the darkness to which the Isha makes reference. It is beyond all limitation by quality, and yet it is not limited by a qualityless void, but is too all infinite qualities. It is the individual soul and all souls, and none of them. It is the formless Brahman and the universe. It is the cosmic and the supracosmic spirit, the supreme Lord, the supreme self, the supreme Purusha and supreme Shakti, the ever unborn who is endlessly born, the infinite, who is innumerably finite, the multitudinous one, the complex simple, the many-sided single, the word of the silence ineffable, the impersonal omnipresent person, the mystery translucent in highest consciousness to its own spirit, but to a lesser consciousness veiled in its own exceeding light and impenetrable forever. These things are to the dimensional mind irreconcilable opposites, but to the constant vision and experience of the supramental truth consciousness, they are so simply and inevitably the intrinsic nature of each other that even to think of them as contraries is an unimaginable violence. The walls constructed by the measuring and separating intellect have disappeared. And the truth, in its simplicity and beauty, appears and reduces all to terms of its harmony and unity and light. Dimensions and distinctions remain, but as figures for use, not a separative prison for the self-forgetting spirit. This is phrasing worthy of his prose in his little book, The Mother. This is grand and sweeping and all-embracing. The Supreme Lord, the Supreme Self, the Supreme Purusha, Supreme Shakti, Purushottama, Paramatman, Parashakti, wonderful. The consciousness of the transcendent absolute, with its consequence in individual and universe, is the last, the eternal knowledge. Our minds may deal with it on various lines, may build upon it conflicting philosophies, may limit, modify, overstress, understress sides of the knowledge, deduce from it truth or error. But our intellectual variations and imperfect statements make no difference to the ultimate fact that if we push thought and experience to their end, this is the knowledge in which they terminate. The object of a yoga of spiritual knowledge can be nothing else than this eternal reality, this self, this Brahman, this transcendent that dwells over all and in all and is manifest yet concealed in the individual, manifest yet disguised in the universe. Brihadaranyaka 4.4.13. He who has found this Atman, that has entered into this conglomerate afflicted abode, he is the creator of everything. He is the creator of all. The world is his. Indeed, he is the world itself. Creator of everything, Vishvakrit. The world is his, the loka. The idea that loka sangraha in the Gita, that holding together the worlds is our service, part of our offering, part of what we give back to the Supreme. By realizing that consciousness and acting in the world from knowledge, we hold the world together. That is our service, our agency for that here. The culmination of the path of knowledge need not necessarily entail extinction of our world existence. So here he's reaching for the practical result of an integral knowledge for us. What are we going to do with it? For the Supreme to whom we assimilate ourselves, the absolute and transcendent into whom we enter, has always the complete and ultimate consciousness for which we are seeking, and yet he supports by it his play in the world. Don't despair. However dark you feel the world to be, however a grim scene of suffering, that is there. That accepts the blow first. Huh. It feels the pang before you do. Neither are we compelled to believe that our world existence ends, because by attaining to knowledge, its object or consummation is fulfilled, and therefore there is nothing more for us here afterwards. So we realize the yoga going up takes us to realization. Pardon me. But the yoga continues as we come back fulfilled. Now we pour out the experience of that oneness, living yoked to the Supreme, in endless acts. But now, wiser, transforming the vehicle in which that conscious soul rides. If we will. For what we gain at first, with its release and immeasurable silence and quietude, is only the eternal self-realization by the individual in the essence of his conscious being. There will still remain on that foundation, unannulled by the silence, one with the release and freedom, the infinitely proceeding self-fulfillment of Brahman. Its dynamic divine manifestation in the individual, and by his presence, example, and action in others, and in the universe at large, the work which the great ones remain to do. These great souls, these Mahatmas, they are here among us, some working quietly. Some admit attention to be drawn to themselves, others decline and simply go forth and do the work. Both work divinely. our dynamic self-fulfillment cannot be worked out so long as we remain in the egoistic consciousness, in the mind's candle-lit darkness, in the bondage. Yes, ego must go. Our present limited consciousness can only be a field of preparation. It can consummate nothing, for all that it manifests is marred through and through by an ego-ridden ignorance and error. The true and divine self-fulfillment of Brahman in the manifestation is only possible on the foundation of the Brahman consciousness, and therefore through the acceptance of life by the liberated soul, the Jivan Mukta. Jivan Mukta, the living being, the conscious soul who has attained release. Release from ignorance, not release from the world. No longer deluded, no longer mistaking the appearance for the reality behind. This is the integral knowledge. For we know that everywhere and in all conditions, all to the eye that sees is one. To a divine experience, all is one block of the divine. It is only the mind which, for the temporary convenience of its own thought and aspiration, seeks to cut an artificial line of rigid division, a fiction of perpetual incompatibility between one aspect and another of the eternal oneness. The liberated knower lives and acts in the world not less than the bound soul and ignorant mind, but more, doing all actions, sarva krit. Only with a true knowledge and a greater conscient power. And so, pardon me, and by so doing, he does not forfeit the supreme unity, nor fall from the supreme consciousness and the highest knowledge. For the supreme, however hidden now to us, is here in the world, no less than he could be in the most utter and ineffable self-extinction, the most intolerant nirvana. So the Brihadaranyaka, that oldest of all the Upanishads, 4.4, 14.15, in that range, says, true, while we are here, ihaiva, we may not know this, if you have known it not. Great is the destruction. Those who know this become immortal. Others go only to sorrow. The Isha Upanishad puts it perhaps more happily. Sixth verse. He who sees everywhere the self in all existences and all existences in the self shrinks not thereafter from anything. You can go fearlessly through the world. Abhaya, without fear. That hand looks like this. He says, fear not, because it is a hand that protects and blesses. Abhaya, be fearless. Be joyous. Be adventurous. The One has created all of this for you to explore, and you're indestructible. Oh, the form, I forgot to say, the form does go. The form is destructible, but you are indestructible. Now, Get to it. Have fun. Find bliss. Discover me everywhere you look. That's God for you. So, we finished the first chapter. What do you say? I think we did. Let's read from Sophetry. This is from Book 7, The Book of Yoga, Canto 6, Nirvana and the All-Negating Absolute. We'll start on page 541. This world is a vast, unbroken totality. A deep solidarity joins its contrary powers. God's summits look back on the mute abyss. So man, evolving to divinest heights, colloques still with the animal and the jinn. The human godhead, with stargazer eyes, lives still in one house with the primal beast. The high meets the low, all is a single plan. So she beheld the many births of thought, if births can be of what eternal is. For the eternal's powers are like himself, timeless in the timeless, in time ever born. This too she saw, that all in outer mind is made, not born, a product perishable, forged in the body's factory by earth force. This mind is a dynamic small machine, producing ceaselessly till it wears out, with raw material drawn from the outside world, the patterns sketched out by an artist god. Often our thoughts are finished cosmic wares, admitted by a silent office gate, and passed through the subconscious galleries, then issued in time's mart as private make. For now they bear the living person's stamp. A trick, a special hue, claims them his own. All else is nature's craft. And this too hers. Our tasks are given, we are but instruments. Nothing is all our own that we create. The power that acts in us is not our force. The genius too receives from some high fount, concealed in a supernal secrecy, the work that gives him an immortal name. The word, the form, the charm, the glory and grace are mission sparks from a stupendous fire, a sample from the laboratory of God, of which he holds the patent upon earth, comes to him wrapped in golden coverings. He listens for inspiration's postman knock and takes delivery of the priceless gift, a little spoilt by the receiver mind or mixed with the manufacture of his brain. When least defaced, then is it most divine. Although his ego claims the world for its use, man is a dynamo for the cosmic work. Nature does most in him, God the high rest. Only his soul's acceptance is his own. This independent, once a power supreme, self-born before the universe was made, accepting cosmos, binds himself, nature's serf, till he becomes her freedman, or God's slave. This is the appearance in our mortal front. Our greater truth of being lies behind. Our consciousness is cosmic and immense, but only when we break through matter's wall, in that spiritual vastness can we stand, where we can live the masters of our world, and mind is only a means and body a tool. For above the birth of body and of thought, our spirit's truth lives in the naked self, and from that height, unbound, surveys the world. Out of the mind she rose to escape its law, that it might sleep in some deep shadow of self, or fall silent in the silence of the unseen. High she attained, and stood from nature free, and saw creation's life from far above. Thence upon all she laid her sovereign will, to dedicate it to God's timeless calm. Then all grew tranquil in her being's space. Only sometimes small thoughts arose and fell, like quiet waves upon a silent sea, or ripples passing over a lonely pool when a stray stone disturbs its dreaming rest. Yet the mind's factory had ceased to work. There was no sound of the dynamo's throb. There came no call from the still fields of life. Then even those stirrings rose in her no more. Her mind now seemed like a vast empty room, or like a peaceful landscape without sound. This men call quietude and prize as peace. But to her deeper sight, all yet was there, effervescing like a chaos under a lid. Feelings and thoughts cried out for word and act, but found no response in the silenced brain. All was suppressed, but nothing yet expunged. At every moment might explosion come. Then this too paused. The body seemed a stone. All now was a wide, mighty vacancy, but still excluded from eternity's hush. For still was far the repose of the absolute and the ocean silence of infinity. Even now, some thoughts could cross her solitude. These surged not from the depths or from within, cast up from formlessness to seek a form, spoke not the body's need, nor voiced life's call. These seemed not born, nor made in human time, children of cosmic nature from a far world, ideas, shapes, incomplete armor of words, posted like travelers in an alien space. Out of some far expanse they seemed to come, as if carried on vast wings like large white sails, and with easy access reached the inner ear, as though they used a natural privileged right to the high royal entries of the soul. As yet their path lay deep concealed in light. Then, looking to know whence the intruders came, she saw a spiritual immensity pervading and encompassing the world space as ether our transparent tangible air, and through it sailing tranquilly a thought. As smoothly glides a ship nearing its port, ignorant of embargo and blockade, confident of entrance and the visa's seal, it came to the silent city of the brain, towards its accustomed and expectant key, but met a barring will, a blow of force, and sank, vanishing in the immensity. After a long vacant pause, another appeared, and others one by one suddenly emerged, minds unexpected visitors from the unseen, like far-off sails upon a lonely sea. But soon that commerce failed. None reached mind's coast. Then all grew still, Nothing moved anymore. Immobile, self-wrapped, timeless, solitary. A silent spirit pervaded silent space. And as you know, this was Sri Aurobindo's immense release in Baroda in 1908. Namaste, Jai Ma.